All right, brothers and sisters, you're listening to the round sounds of 104.1 Berkeley Liberation Radio. We have a very interesting program for you today, including reports, facts, news that you can use, and two very good interviews. So keep it locked here at Berkeley Liberation Radio.
Watch the mic.
All right, brothers and sisters, this is Black Uhuru with Flying Robbie. This is the song that got them the Grammy in 1985.
Everybody wants the same thing, don't they? Everybody wants a happy end. They want to see the game on Saturday. They want to be somebody's friend. Everybody want to work for a living. Everybody want their children warm. Everybody wants to be forgiven. They want a shelter from the storm.
Look at me, I ain't an enemy. We walk on common ground. We don't need to fight each other.
What we need, what we need. Solidarity.
Oh,
solidarity. Solidarity.
Oh, yeah.
Solidarity. Nobody likes to ask for money. Nobody likes to play the clown. Nobody likes to wait in a long line. Nobody likes being pushed around. Everybody wants a family protected. They wanna express themselves. Everybody wants to live forever.
Look at me, I ain't an enemy. Don't believe everything you hear. This is no time to fight each other.
What we need, what we need. Solidarity. Solidarity.
Oh,
solidarity. Solidarity.
Oh, yeah.
Solidarity. Solidarity.
As I said, we have a very interesting program this morning for you. Just want to give you a little news that you can use. This past Friday, that is, not Friday, excuse me, it was Thursday, there was a demonstration at the State Building located in Oakland. The demonstration was against California Attorney General Kamala Harris. And the reason people were protesting her is because a group calling itself the Alan Bluford Committee, wrote her and asked her to examine the police report that described their son's murder, and also asked them her to reconsider whether or not the policeman, Basso, should be indicted. She looked, first, she didn't answer for a long time, is what I heard from the participants. And when she did, she finally answered and said that after looking over the documents, she thinks that there was no policy that was violated. A man's dead, that was a young man, 18 years old, is dead, was on the ground. His last words was, "What did I do?" He's murdered by this Oakland policeman, and there's no contradiction between justice and the law in terms of policy. So we were out there, there were approximately 150 people, and some of the demonstrators were arrested. They did a civil disobedience inside the state building. They refused to leave when the building was closed and were arrested. They were all cited and released. And the reason this was important was because the Justice for Alan Bluford Coalition pulled together at least 10 families who themselves were the loved ones of victims of police brutality. So, you know, it's like, how do you deal with this recurring problem of police shooting unarmed citizens and not even being indicted? We have to think about this. I think they're going in the right direction by identifying Kamala Harris as a part of the problem. Because as we used to say back in the day, you're either part of the problem or part of the solution. Well, clearly, Kamala Harris is part of the problem. Okay, we got, let me share this here. You know, there's something called the DAC, the Domain Awareness Center. Where you go, they are going to bring together all of the cameras in the city of Oakland, on the port and in the schools and in the streets, so that the authorities will then know where you're going and when, who you are and who you're with, what you're texting and tweeting, the words you speak and the words you write. Well, actually, the cameras don't do that, but that's more getting into the NSA collecting all of our the so-called metadata. An all-seeing eye throughout Oakland and its port with surveillance, primarily in areas with people of color and the poor, in public housing and public schools. Well, personally, I'm a person of color myself. I don't give a damn if there's a lot of people of color in the city of Oakland. That's not the issue. The issue is not race here. The issue is our relationship with the state. That's the issue. All right. Now, this proposal is not going to stop crime. Surveillance has been shown to be ineffective at that. But to create a sense of dread, track protesters, and dissuade those trying to exercise their rights to speak and assemble. Touted as able to, quote, keep tabs on port labor action. So they're trying to watch the longshoremen. See, a lot of people don't know this, but there are, sometimes you have a major strike where everybody in the union goes on strike. I used to be a longshoreman years ago, back in the 70s, and I can tell you, on a daily basis, the class struggle continues, sometimes very visible, sometimes almost invisible. But we were trained as longshoremen. If you see a safety violation, let's say, you don't wait until somebody gets killed and say, oh my God. You take action right then, right now. You do not allow your life to be in danger, okay? And as such, they called us traveling stewards, meaning a traveling shop steward. That means every member should take active concern in not only his safety, but the safety of all waterfront workers and longshoremen. That was the RLW I joined back in 1975. Things have changed quite a bit, but clearly, the 1% is concerned. They want the cameras on us 24/7. So this apparatus has been assembled by a contractor called SAIC, which defrauded New York City for over $1 billion. And in direct violation of Oakland's nuclear free zone ordinance, it could now be integrated by another contractor, Schneider Electric, who also is a nuclear contractor, which is in violation of the nuclear free zone ordinance that Oakland passed. Now, here's what, this sounds petty, but, you know, I tell you what, anything to stop them. Years ago, Berkeley and Oakland voted ordinances, local ordinances that said we're not going to deal with nuclear contractors. Well, here we are now. They want to get this domain awareness center set up, but the contractor clearly has a record of working for the nuclear industry. What next? We'll see. But it's going to require your attention. Keep your eyes open. In the East Bay Express, there was a series of articles on this matter of the Domain Awareness Center. And I think if you go and check out your computer and read some of those articles, you'll see what I'm talking about. Okay? Now, this is Black History Month. So all Black History Month, you know, you look around and you wonder if you look at black people. I'm in the black people. I'm black. And you don't see as many celebrations. You don't see, certainly the schools don't organize much. I just gave 4 classes at Oakland High on the subject of black history. And I think we're going to open up with that before our interview. So here we go. The real question now, what's it to you? A lot of white people have been trained to believe, and it's wrong. Well, I'm not black, so, you know, black history just doesn't concern me. That's a mistake. Actually, black history, that is, the actual history of what occurred in America, affects us all and is a concern to us all. Why is black history still relevant? Well, I'll give you a couple of reasons right now. One, because black people are still oppressed. This idea that because a black man was elected to be the president of the United States, the chief executive of the 1%, it does not mean that the legacy and the history of black people is no longer relevant. Particularly, well, one might ask, well, this isn't this post-racial America? Look, you got your black president, shut up, go away. It's not quite so simple, my friend. Are black people still oppressed? Does this require proof? So many instances would prove it, but I'm going to mention 3 things right now to lay this to rest, whether or not black people are still oppressed in America. This is ridiculous. One, look at the police murders. We can start off with Oscar Grant, Raheem Brown, Kenneth Harding. Unfortunately, a fairly long list of citizens who have been killed by the police demonstrates them. Not that Caucasians are never killed by the police. That is a crackpot nationalist assertion. Of course, the police kill everybody. They're equal opportunity killers. But certainly, the oppression of black people is manifested through the largely disproportionate number of black people that are killed by the police. How about the prisons? Are black people still oppressed? Black people, let's say there's approximately 300 million people in America. Black people, population of black people, roughly 40 million. Let's say about 12% of the population. Black people are a numerical minority in America. Well, in the prisons, you wouldn't think so. If you go into prisons, half the damn prisons are made up of black people. So this whole phenomenon of the prison industrial complex, of what they call justice in America, reveals that something is very, very wrong with our judicial system in terms of racial prejudice, the way people are policed, and above all, the way people are sent to that big house. So the prisons reveal an ugly reality of racism in America. How about unemployment? They say that the national rate of unemployment is approximately 7%, let's say. So let's just go along with that figure right now, only to make this point that you go to a city like Detroit and you start to look at young people or people under 30, the unemployment rate, 70%. 70% of the people under 30 in Detroit are unemployed. So, one, this shows that the youth carry the brunt of the pressure and the burden of unemployment in this society. But it also shows what a farce it is to talk about 7% unemployment. If you go to any of the major metropolitan areas in the United States where there is a significant black population, if you track the actual percentage of young black people, let's say under 25, hands down, repeatedly, you're going to find over 50% unemployment in almost every major metropolitan area in the United States. Jack Hughes, racism. Don't kid yourself. Even black people want to go to work. All right, let us continue. The second reason that black history is still relevant is because black history makes up some of the missing pages of human history. In fact, black history, women's history, labor history, all constitute many of the missing pages of human history. And here's how it affects not just blacks, women, or people that are labor advocates or labor union members. It affects everybody, because if it's true that black history makes up some of the missing pages of America, of human history, excuse me, therefore, without an understanding of black history, women's history, and labor history, it is impossible to get a full understanding of human history. But you might ask, well, hell, why are there missing pages? Why don't they just give me the whole truth and nothing but the truth? Life is not so simple, my friends. In case you haven't noticed, much of what passes as history is inaccurate and not scientifically based, because every dominant group, the 1% or the ruling class in human history, seeks to enhance their own image, very often to the detriment of the truth. Thus, we are told, for instance, that black people were happy under slavery. I'm sorry if I raise my voice there, but it really irks me. I can't stand this idea that in some way slavery was a pleasant experience. I had the first thing came to my mind. I guess black people got a special joy that went into our hearts every time we felt the lash. And what I mean by that, a part of slavery was the coercion and terror directed against the slaves to keep them in line. After Nat Turner's rebellion in 1831, the whole South was turned into an armed camp. It became illegal to teach a slave how to read. People that tried to teach other black people how to read, they cut off their body parts. Yes, black history is the missing pages of American history, of human history. Beatings with whips basically was a part of slavery. Very few slaves escaped that lash. You might want to, all right, so then what is history? Can we even know what history is? History is a study of past events, particularly related to human affairs, generally. That's a general definition. But in order to appreciate history, you have to understand from which perspective it is delivered. You have to find out about it, not only from an author from the ivory towers of academia, but it wouldn't hurt to check out the people that actually lived it and advocated it. So, for instance, if I want to know what slavery is about, and I'm not talking no anti-white nationalist trash here, right? I bet you get a better idea if you read a slave narrative. Believe it or not, after slavery was abolished, black people wrote about slavery. You want to know about slavery? Ask people who went through it. You want to know about the abolitionist movement? There are very good authors who have written tracts about the abolitionist movement. But there are also very real people who participated in the abolitionist movement, like Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass was not only a great man in many ways, a former slave, he escaped slavery, wound up in Europe. People didn't even believe he was a slave because he taught himself to read and to speak publicly. And people could not believe, they challenged him when he was in England. They said, "You're no slave. Obviously, you've been to college. No slave can talk like that." Frederick Douglass took his shirt off in the forum to show people the wounds from the lashes that he had received as a slave. People were aghast. But you see, this is history. This is understanding what actually went on. If you want to know about the abolitionist movement, ask an abolitionist. Read Frederick Douglass's work. Read William Lloyd Garrison, Wendell Phillips, an almost endless list of honorable human beings that you can read to find out what it was really like, what the Underground Railroad was about. These things have been written about, and here's the problem. You have to use your head. Before you read a history book, what I mean when I say you have to understand from which perspective it is delivered, you have to understand the author of that book. Because the author of that book may be a racist. Here we go. Let me show you something. After the North betrayed the black people after Reconstruction and withdrew the troops from the South, that was the betrayal of Reconstruction. After the Civil War, there was a period of Reconstruction in America. Black people actually exercised their right to vote, and there was stiff pushback from the racist elements in the South. Black people were betrayed by the Republican Party, who basically horse traded the elections for president for an agreement with the former slave owners, basically, to pull out of the South, which they did. There was a counter-revolution at that point, which forced black people out of the government, out of all of the positions that black people won legitimately in elections. And for 100 years, Jim Crow terror ruled in the South. Okay? Now, because the North had said, "To hell with it, you can do whatever you want with these Negroes," and pull the troops out, there emerged a school of thought called the Bourbon School of Southern History. And this Bourbon School of Southern History is almost, you know, if people were not lynched and beaten and cheated and oppressed, it would be funny, because I've been reading this stuff and just scratching my head at how amazingly, the word stupid doesn't explain it, but false consciousness might be a better term. Many of the Southern Bourbon history advocates, they still wrote as late as the 1900s how happy black people were to be slaves. And I want to tell you something, brothers and sisters, they're bringing it back now. They got people now that are writing foolishness about slavery wasn't all that bad. You're better off being a slave here than being in Africa. We left our minds in Africa. Let me tell you something. There's nothing positive about chattel slavery. But let us proceed. So once again, which perspective is the history being delivered? There's an excellent book by a man named E.H. Carr, and that's the name of the book, What is History? And he explains this. You can read about the same subject, be it the Civil War, be it World War I, World War II, from different perspectives. And then hopefully you can figure out what you think. And that's what really matters, learning from history. Okay, here we go. Now, one of the most important moments in black history, or I call it black history, was the Negro Renaissance. And I know, unfortunately, people don't know about it anymore. Well, we don't know about it because we don't talk about it. So let me very quickly, we got plenty of time, lay out the basics for you. What was the Negro Renaissance? The Negro Renaissance was a celebration of African-American heritage and culture between 1919 and the mid-1930s, manifested through an outpouring of new businesses, art, literature, music, politics, and dance. This boom of expression, also called the New Negro Movement, had long-lasting positive effects on the social, intellectual, and economic standing of African Americans. People consider that the period to be a significant foundation for the civil rights movement of the 1960s, and that's a fact. Now, you might say, well, how did this Negro Renaissance, why all of a sudden 1919, why would it start in 1919? All right, here we go. Here's the question. What were the material conditions that made the Negro Renaissance, a kind of rebirth of black culture, possible? Well, look, start off with objective reality. World War I breaks out August 4th, 1914. As a result, World War I led to a labor shortage. Many white citizens who, let's say, worked in meatpacking industries, automobile industries, had to go to war. They were drafted, so they went to war. Well, does that mean that people don't need to eat meat anymore? Does that mean that we don't want to make any more cars because somebody had to go to fight a war? No. The owners of the factories who discriminated, who actively discriminated against blacks, would not hire blacks, were in a quandary. Either they changed their racist policy or they can't produce anything. There was a demand for black labor. So what did this lead to? Blacks were actively recruited from the South to come to northern industrial centers to work. In so doing, compacted, highly populated black urban centers, or ghettos, were created. In fact, I have here before me an ad. It says, help wanted, male, men. If you are seeking employment, come to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Wages, $2.50 to $6 per day. Board and lodging, reasonable. This was put in a Southern newspaper. Now, a lot of young people, because of a lack of historical understanding, say, oh, gee, ain't nobody working for no $6 a day. You crazy, man. We trying to get 15 an hour. Yeah, I understand we're trying to get 15 an hour. We need to get 15 an hour. But we need to also have some sense of proportion and history. Believe it or not, in 1915, when this ad came out, or 14 when this ad came out, $2.50 a day wasn't bad. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm going to share a little experience I have so you get a sense. My family owned a farm in the South, so when we weren't working on our own farm, our family would farm us out to work on other farms in the local area. So, for instance, we went over and we would pick cotton from another farm. What does that entail? What does that mean? To pick the cotton, they give you a bag, right? A big old bag. You take the bag and you start stuffing it with cotton. You just take the balls of cotton, throw it in the bag. At the end of the day, you take that bag and you weigh it. If you have at the time, if my memory serves me right, we got $1.50 for 100 pounds of cotton. Now I want you to stop and think. Because of racism, back in, I'm talking about the early 1900s, or, you know, remember, this is intense Jim Crow terror that's going on. One guy might have picked, let's say, 150 pounds worth of cotton. So he goes to collect his money, throws the bag on the scale. He says, okay, boss, I got 150 pounds. The southern white man looks at him and says, well, I see 80. The brother said, wait a minute, man, that's 150 pounds. What you doing? What you talking about? The southern white might retort something like, boy, you giving me trouble? Next thing you know, the sheriff comes and arrests the black man that was disputing with the man weighing the cotton, and he's on a state farm now, a prison, picking cotton and not getting paid at all. It was pretty rough under Jim Crow terror, and that's what it was, terror. So believe it or not, $2.50 to $6 a day represented a significant upgrade for people in the South that were working, let's say, as sharecroppers, white and black. Understand that. So we need a sense of history. How much did people make? Things like that. You know, understand your country. Understand what we've been through. Now, with these large urban ghettos came the economic basis for black art, literature, and culture. By creating what they call today market spheres, I don't like all that old fancy talk. Creating a group of people who were working and had some damn money. So what do you think black people did when they got move up north, you get a little job, you know, you're paying to stay, you're renting a little room or an apartment? Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association was another manifestation of the growth of the black community. This became a mass movement of tens of thousands of militants. And Marcus Garvey correctly pointed out that, you know what, if you're going to buy a doll for your child, why don't you buy a doll that teaches the child to love their own skin color? Why don't, instead of buying a white doll, why don't you buy a black doll? And indeed, somebody listened to that. They started creating black dolls and started selling black dolls to the black community. This was a manifestation of the black renaissance coming to consciousness. To black, according to Marcus Garvey, black is beautiful. And you know what? That lasted. That understanding lasted for some time. The number of black newspapers rose. I'm talking about newspapers like the Amsterdam News, the Chicago Defender, and the Pittsburgh Courier. These were top flight newspapers because the so-called mainstream or the corporate, capitalist corporate press simply didn't cover black affairs very much. But black people still wanted to know what's going on in their community. So only by buying the black newspapers could they find out. This was also a period of the flowering of blues in the urban areas and jazz as an art form that took the nation. Clubs like the Cotton Club in Harlem really took off. Just one second, please. Excuse me. Okay, so the Cotton Club, the entertainment industry was taken by jazz. Believe it or not, jazz was the national music that was the pop music in America. Now, we're talking mostly swing, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Billie Holiday. These type of names come to mind. Okay, also black people, or black men, went into the armed services. Now, why do I mention this? Ooh, isn't that terrible? Yeah, I guess so. War is hell. When will it end? But in fact, you have to look at all sides of the matter. By going into the service, a lot of black men were acquainted with the use of weapons. And after using them against the Germans in Europe, they were not so hesitant to use them against the Ku Klux Klan right here in the United States. An organization such as the African Blood Brotherhood emerged that organized veterans to defend the community, because after the war, there was a rash of race riots in America. Many of the white soldiers came back and felt entitled and felt that they should get their jobs in the factories back. Well, life is not so simple. Many of the blacks that entered those, that took those jobs, joined the union. And the union determined, no, you don't fire somebody just because somebody else. You just have to get back and get in line, sir. Well, this caused a lot of social tension, and there were major race riots all over the United States. Chicago, 1919. Tulsa, 1920. But this time, for the first time in American history, black people were not the only victims. While certainly blacks died in disproportionate numbers, disproportionately high numbers, there were also black victims. They found out white people can die too. Now, a little bit about this new Negro. Who was this new Negro, and what does that mean? Part of the oppression of blacks was so intense. My own experience, I have to share with you to give you a sense. And when I was sent down south by my family, I was sent every summer because they didn't want me roaming the streets by myself as I wanted to, running around, catching hell, getting in trouble, just doing things unsupervised. So they sent me down south. Well, while I was down south, I noticed something. We went to town, And I'm a little kid from New York. I don't know. I'm telling everybody, I'm from New York. Now, this is around the time that Emmett Till had just been killed. And my poor family down south was absolutely petrified that I was going to get lynched. Because this is the kind of stuff I pull. I didn't know. I was a child. Please, have a little mercy. I saw my uncle talking to a white person, and he was looking at the ground. And I didn't understand it. I'm a kid now. Come on. I was probably about 6 years old at the time. But children are intelligent, and my father tells me I was more intelligent when I was six than when I was 11. I think that's probably true. I looked at my uncle and I elbowed him. I said, "Hey, straighten up, man. What's wrong with you?" Because I didn't understand. They said, "That's it. No more town for you." They kept me on the farm because my ignorance and not understanding the social mores and customs of the South, believe it or not, could have led to a little kid being injured and attacked and assaulted, because that's how intense the terror was. So the new Negro here, I've got a beautiful picture here of a march of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, that is the Garvey movement, and they're carrying this large sign that says, "The new Negro knows no fear." And I thought about it. I said, "Well, what is they talking about?" Well, that's exactly what they were talking about. Keep your head up. Straighten your back up. You're a human being. Demand to be treated as one. That's one of the things that the black liberation movement has. That's the first step of creating a bona fide black liberation movement. And finally, the story of Black History Month itself begins in Chicago during the late summer of 1915. It was founded by a guy who really started it off. It was a guy named Carter G. Woodson, who lived from 1875 to 1950. An alumnus of the University of Chicago with many friends in the city, Carter G. Woodson traveled from Washington, D.C. to participate in a national celebration of the 50th anniversary of emancipation, sponsored by the state of Illinois. So now let me see if I can explain this to you. At this time that we're talking now, 1915, black people celebrated Lincoln's birthday. Lincoln's birthday was important to us. This is the president that signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Mr. Lincoln's, we used to call him. All right? Well, hell, stop and think about it. It makes sense. The fact that we were emancipated was a good thing. We had a side in the Civil War, and our side was the Union side. And despite all of the ritual and the pomp and circumstance they have today in the South commemorating the Civil War and talking bullshit about the South will rise again, you lost. The South lost. Get over it, okay? Now, at this time, though, so once a year they would have this commemoration of the Emancipation Proclamation. Well, look what happened. Now, stop it. Well, it was actually the end of the Civil War they were commemorating. So what happened? You had all these blacks, as I described earlier, that moved from the South to the northern industrial centers. So there were 12,000 people standing outside of this exhibition seeking to enter. So Carter G. Woodson thought to himself and said to his friend, "Hey, we need to do something with this. People do want to commemorate and respect themselves and their history. Let's start something. Let's do something about this." So because the period that black people thought was really relevant in February, you know, you hear a lot of empty-headed so-called critics say, "Well, why is Black History Month in February, the shortest month of the year?" Okay, moron, I'll tell you why. Because one, Abraham Lincoln's birthday was, the 12th of February, and Frederick Douglass's birthday was the 14th. For the black, a conscious black community struggling for its liberation, those were significant dates. So what happened was, they started it off as Negro History Week in 1944. They succeeded in getting national recognition for Negro History Week. In 1976, under the Carter administration, Negro History Month was inaugurated. And the rest is history, okay? Know your history. We'll be back talking about more of this, but right now I've got a special guest that I can't wait to introduce you to. He's not just a guest, but he is also, in my opinion, someone you should really consider listening to. He is running on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket to be a legislator in this state. Now, we've got the best legislators that money can buy. And that's the problem. Money done bought them. They're bought and sold. We got laws on the books you don't even know about that attack you. All right? Well, is there any alternative? Is there anything we can do about this? Well, I'll tell you what. The one thing we can do about it is stop supporting the parties of the 1%. And I'm talking about the Democrats and the Republicans. But I think we should listen to Mr. Gene Rule, because I think he will give us some ideas on why we should consider voting for him. Gene?
Thank you, Gerald. And it's very good to be here. And thank you for that history. I think it's something everybody needs to know, as you said. Everybody needs to know about black history. Now, the campaign that I'm here to talk about is, I don't want to say it's my campaign, it's Campaign for Peace and Socialism, and that campaign is not about me. It's about giving the voters of the 15th Assembly District something to vote for, giving them a chance to vote against the war-addicted pro-capitalist parties, the Democrats and Republicans, and vote for something, for peace, and for socialism.
Now, listen to what he's saying. This is not a negative rebel here just talking bad about the Democrats and the Republicans. He's saying, while we can be against the 1%, we have to be for something.
Okay, I ran in 2012 and got 25,000 votes. That means that 25,000 people in the 15th Assembly District, there's over 100,000 people there, but 25,000 of them decided to vote for socialism and not for capitalism. So I think that's important. So that's why I'm running this campaign. Now, you know, the Peace and Freedom Party was formed out of the anti-racist and anti-imperialist struggle of the 1960s. And we were supported, and we supported the Black Panthers. And this was a period when the Democrats had already sold out, not just black people, but people across the United States. You know what about the Freedom Democratic Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Right.
They organized.
Now, since you mentioned it, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to explain that, because I got bad news for you. A lot of people don't. Hey, a lot of people don't know who. In fact, I was going to talk about Mary Lou Hammer, but I'll talk about her after we finish with you. But why don't you tell us, since you mentioned it, just tell us what the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was. You mentioned it.
Okay, this is 1964. Now, earlier in 1964, July, I think it was, there are three people, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. These were three civil rights workers that were shot by the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi. And that was part of this whole political ferment throughout the South with the civil rights movement and people agitating for the right to vote. Part of this was black people in Mississippi organized the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party because they thought black people should have the vote. And they went to the Democratic National Convention and they said, don't vote, you know, don't let these Dixiecrats into the convention to represent us. We want to be represented. And they were right. And everybody at that convention knew that they were right, that black people should be represented in the Democratic National Convention. However, a lot of people didn't think so, and one of them was Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson knew that he had to have the support of the Dixiecrats in order to get elected. So basically what he did is he sold out the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and told them, well, they could have two seats and they could sit in the back and listen to what was going on. And you mentioned Fannie Lou Hammer. She said, well, we didn't come all this way for no two seats because all of us is tired. And we all want to be seated. So that was what happened in 1964. Well, a lot of people said, well, we still need to vote for LBJ because they have this fascist, Barry Goldwater, who was going to get us to a war, into a war in Vietnam. And nobody wanted a war in Vietnam. So 1964, we went all the way with LBJ because he was going to keep us out of the Vietnam War. Now, you know what happened?
No.
What happened is LBJ got us into war in Vietnam. He lied about the Gulf of Tonkin, just like Bush later on. Lied about those weapons of mass destruction. Just back in 1898, they lied about the, you know, remember the Maine. One lie after another. So LBJ got us into war. And a lot of people were really pissed off at the Democratic Party. Partly because they were a racist party. Partly because they were an imperialist party. So out of this twin struggle, people mobilized and they said, well, we need to take this into the electoral arena. And that's why the Peace and Freedom Party was organized as a working class, socialist, and feminist party.
To be a little more precise, though, Gene, I'd like to say, if I recall, the Peace and Freedom Party didn't officially become a socialist party until 1984. When they actually changed the Constitution and made socialism their goal. Initially, the Peace and Freedom Party in 1967 did not include socialism, I believe, in its program. Is that accurate?
It is accurate. I'm not sure exactly when they adopted socialism as part of their platform, but I know back in the 70s, I returned to California in 1976. I saw Peace and Freedom there as one of the options. I could register Peace and Freedom. I registered Peace and Freedom. Then I got active politically. I was in Long Beach. I joined, got active with C.T. Weber and others down there in Long Beach because they had an active Peace and Freedom party going there, and in 1982, I decided to, or CT talked me into running for Congress on the Peace and Freedom ticket. And at that time, it must have been socialist because I was a socialist, and I wouldn't have run for a party that wasn't socialist.
Okay.
So it was also a socialist and a feminist party. And we have the slogan, women run for office, not coffee, in the Peace and Freedom Party.
That's right. Yeah. And in fact, there have been many, many women candidates for the Peace and Freedom Party. But let's talk about your candidacy right now. What district are you running? Could you explain that and explain the boundaries of the district? Give us a little sense of the demographics of the district so that people can at least know if they can vote for you. Because everyone can't vote for you. In order to vote for you, my understanding is people have to live in that district.
People have to live in the 15th Assembly District to vote for me. However, as you know, people throughout California can vote for other Peace and Freedom Party candidates like Cindy Sheehan, who's running for governor, and like Natalie Hertzey, who's running for insurance commissioner. And as you know, this is a vital position. Insurance commissioner, health insurance. We want single-payer health care here in California. So Peace and Freedom Party is putting forth a unified socialist platform that is in the interests of working people throughout California. So you don't have to live in the 15th Assembly District to vote for Peace and Freedom. Now, if, however, you live in the 15th Assembly District, you're particularly lucky because you can vote for my candidacy. So that is centered around Berkeley. It's north through Richmond, San Pablo, Hercules is all part of the 15th Assembly District, down to into North Oakland where I live, down about to MacArthur Boulevard, including all of Emeryville and Piedmont. And up into the hills is kind of complicated.
On the east border, what is the east border in Oakland?
East Border is probably Tilden Park. And the whole park system. It goes up into the hills. But it's really, it's gerrymandered pretty well there. So I can't tell you there. I have a map if you want to look at the map.
Well, look, I'll tell you what. How do you know, as a voter, what district you're in? Because I tell you what, I didn't know about districts until I ran for office myself back in 1996. I ran for school board for District 3. Now, it was a lot less complicated because I lived in West Oakland. District 3 was West Oakland, all the way to downtown, all the way to the waterfront. So the water was basically my border. And so it was a lot easier for people to understand that you live in West Oakland, that's it. Here, if you own a computer, you can very easily Google it and find out what district, show a map of District 15, is that right? So that you can know if you can vote for this man. I bet you many of you can. And I bet you that would be your best bet. Okay? Now, let's go on now. I know you're going to run now. Good. We're going to do what we can to make sure we can bring it to people's attention. That's good. But let's use our imagination and creativity a minute. We know that you're not a rich man. People do give you contributions. And if people wanted to give a contribution to your campaign, how could they do that?
As I said, this campaign is not about me, about my money and so forth. So I don't want people to contribute to my campaign. I want people to contribute to the Peace and Freedom Party registration campaign because, as you know, it's a big struggle in terms of getting the right to vote. And ever since the Voting Rights Act was passed, they've been trying to undermine that. Now, one of the things they did to undermine that was Prop 14, right?
That's what it is.
That was the so-called top two. So no longer do you vote for a particular party.
Explain what that top two means.
The top two meant that political parties don't put people on the ballot anymore. It used to be Peace and Freedom Party could put people on the ballot, just like the Green Party, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party. Now, no party can put anybody on the ballot. Everybody has to run together in the primary and the top two, meaning the top two richest people, people who have the most campaign contributions but run the biggest campaigns, they turn up into the final election. But you might want to say a little bit more on that.
Yeah.
All right. That's how it has been working. That is not how it has to work. Because we are no longer chattel slaves. And take the chain off your brain. Can I tell you something? We can go and pull the lever for the Peace and Freedom Party. You can do that. And if we do, let me tell you, at least then you can respect yourself for not voting for the parties of the 1%. So while what Gene is saying is certainly true, that money has ruled in these elections, I want you to hear something. He got 25. When I ran against Barbara Lee, I only got 5,000 votes, man. Now, I got more when I ran for state treasury, but I got 80,000 or something like that. But look, 25,000 votes is not negligible. I'm actually kind of optimistic, bruh, because I'm going to tell you something. These Democrats, tell me, what have the Democrats done to really make your life better? All told, nothing. Come on. They're always negotiating with the Republicans as to how much they're going to screw us. Okay? Those two parties of the ruling class, of the 1%, collaborate in exploiting and oppressing the people. Let's face it. So what Gene says is true. But is what Gene says, does it have to be true? Is there nothing we can do about this? No. We can break out of this losing cycle of supporting the parties of the 1%. We can vote for our own class interest by voting for the Peace and Freedom Party. Now, I want to ask you this question, Gene. See, I think 25,000 votes is a lot. I think you know, you saying you don't want nobody to give you the contribution. Okay, I think y'all might consider giving him one. 25,000 votes is not bad. And he's obviously working on this. He's getting around. He's trying to raise the banner every place he can. So you got to stop and think about this for a minute. What if Gene won? What if we get him here in this studio regularly? We get the word out. And people actually vote for Gene Rule. And Gene Rule got more than 51% of the vote for this legislative contest. What the hell would you do then, Gene? The only socialist in a reactionary legislative body. But what would you do?
Well, first of all, I think the question is a little bit backwards, because it's not a question of what I would do, it's what the people would do.
Okay.
Because power goes to the people. And we have this idea, oh, we got to elect good legislators, we got to elect a new Congress, we got to elect a new president. No, it's the power of the people that changes things. That's the case, you know, Frederick Douglass says, power concedes nothing, only struggle. That's the only way people are going to change things. So it's not about what I would do in Sacramento. But since you asked that question, there are a lot of things that people can that we can do. If I were elected, I would support... wrote down the names, but unfortunately didn't bring it with me. But there's a prison reform movement. You know about that. You know, get rid of this school-to-prison pipeline that we have and get rid of this prison-industrial complex, which, as you know, is the new Jim Crow here in California. So we need to get rid of that. That's something that we need to work with those organizations that are pushing for reform there. Yeah.
Excuse me, I don't mean to be cutting this brother off, because he's laying down some really useful information here. But I did want to say one thing. Do you know the people have been fighting against this torture in prison, particularly talking about Pelican Bay, and about solitary confinement used as a means of torture? And do you know that it's starting to have an effect? That actually I've been reading, they're actually going to... Now, let's see how this works out. But from what I've read in the newspapers, which I admit is not always accurate, they're talking about loosening up some of the constraints and the procedure for putting people in solitary confinement for life. You put somebody in solitary confinement for life. We're not talking about, you know, a month or, you know, somebody getting a fight, so you break them up and maybe they're in, you know, in the hole for a day or so. We're talking about for life. They put people in solitary confinement at Pelican Bay for life. And it looks like we've been chipping away at that. And it looks like we're having the people, exactly what Gene said, are having some effect on this very important matter.
And you know, Gerald, people around the world understand that solitary confinement is torture. So we need to get that idea. But there's other issues, healthcare. Jobs, a whole series of them. One of my favorite issues is what's right in the middle of the 15th Assembly District, the University of California. And you might ask yourselves, well, why is the University of California designing nuclear weapons? Because the case is that every nuclear weapon in the United States arsenal since the bombs that demolished Hiroshima and Nagasaki, every one of those weapons was designed at one of three laboratories, all of which are run by the University of California. So the University of California, which is a state agency created by the people of California to educate our children, our kids, in the University of California, the state colleges, the community colleges, that was created by the people of California, but it was taken over by the capitalists, by the corporate capitalism, to produce nuclear weapons. Now, you know, don't they teach ethics in the philosophy department at Berkeley? You would think so. But they're going to keep doing that. So that is one of the issues that needs to be raised. The slogan I'm using for my campaign, end the wars and tax the rich, because that's how we're going to solve the problems we have here in California and around the world. And these problems are not going to be solved simply by electing me and I'll solve all those problems. They're going to be solved by working class people here in the United States realizing that they have more in common with workers in South America, with workers in Africa, India, China, throughout the world. Workers around the world need to get together and decide the system of corporate capitalism isn't working for us. It's working great for the corporations. It's working great for the bankers. But it's not working good for the majority of people, of human beings on this planet. So we need to change that. And voting peace and freedom in this election and registering peace and freedom is one small step. But with only a small step, we need to keep pushing that movement on. We need to keep the movement moving, as they say. Yeah. So, I think this campaign is important. And I'm hoping that people won't vote for one of the Tweedledum, Tweedledee candidates that are running in the 15th Assembly District, that they will vote peace and freedom in the coming elections.
Well, thank you very much for that, but I'm not through with you. You know, I'll be grabbing you. You ain't going nowhere. Hold on a minute. Hold on 1 minute, because I don't know. That question I asked you maybe was quite unfair, because I've studied the history of socialist legislators being elected to state assemblies and the Congress. Do you know that members of the Socialist Party won the election in, I think, from Wisconsin or from Wisconsin, I forget which district, and they didn't seat them in the Congress? This actually happened here in the United States. Yes, in the this is our democracy. So listen, this requires some attention, some thought, because Gene is absolutely right. Him winning the election is not the solution, but a small part of it. But I want to say this, though, Gene. Don't play it down, because if you were to win the election, let me tell you something. One, it inspires people. Let's take, for instance, recently, a woman of ethnic Indian heritage. He's going to tell your name because I can't pronounce it. Was recently elected to the city council in Seattle. So this happens. We're not talking about somebody from outer space winning an election. We're talking about people who have the interests of the working people at heart. Tell us a little bit about what you know about her victory.
Not as much as I should, but I believe I pronounced it Kasami Sawant. Was a member of Socialist Alternatives. And she ran first for the Washington Assembly, got about 20-25% of the vote, but then ran again for Seattle City Council. She mobilized over 100 volunteers to work on her campaign, raised over $100,000, and she won that election. And people around the country are saying, whoa, this is a very important thing. Now she's got the issue, well, how does she push her socialist values in that very capitalist setting of the city council? And she's doing this on the one hand by pushing the $15 minimum wage amendment, which we need. And you know, peace and freedom, our slogan is the same slogan as Karl Marx and the Wobblies, you know. We don't seek a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. We seek abolition of the wages system. We seek guaranteed for jobs for everybody with a guaranteed decent income as a basic human rights. You know, after World War II, they passed, you know, the United Nations passed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That was endorsed by the United States. And those human rights include a guaranteed job, not just a guaranteed job, but a socially useful guaranteed job with a decent income. Now, minimum wage is just barely enough. It's not even enough to get along. So people deserve a human existence. People deserve enough income to buy the things that they need, and that would stabilize our economy. That would be a continual demand, so you wouldn't have these fluctuations, these periodic crises that we have that are a inescapable part of the capitalist system, as you know. You've read Marx on that.
Don't be giving me away. What you talking about? I done read some Marx. You don't know me. He's absolutely right. I have read Marx, and I know exactly what he's talking about. But I tell you something, Mr. Big Shot. Yeah, I do favor the abolition of the wage system and the creation of a worker state. And that would move in the direction of socialism, which means from each according to his ability to each according to his need. But I have to say this, my friend. A half a loaf is better than none. I think it would not be a bad thing to see a significant increase in the minimum wage. Because what people are making, $7, $8 an hour, whatever it is, hey man, that's not enough to live off of. I'm a retired electrician, and I make more money as a retired person than some people that work for a living. Something's wrong with that. I don't feel guilty. Now, wait a minute. Let me tell you. Let's understand this. This ain't no guilt. I worked for my pension. Went on strike. Supported the picket line. Built the union. Did all the things that any conscious union member would do. And, of course, did my work. And they worked the hell out of me. I'm crippled now behind that shit. I mean, my legs are gone. Now, my mistake. Working without knee pads was not very bright. That didn't help me. But understand, the unions fought for pensions, for the right, you know, too old to work, too young to die. Pensions. That's what we fought for, and we won. And we will continue to win if we keep our heads screwed on properly. But I think it's not a bad thing to win a wage increase for the working class as a whole, even if it doesn't lead to an immediate social overturn. So, you know, I support the, you know, increase in the minimum wage. And so does peace and freedom. While we also support the abolition of the wage system. We want to go in that direction. But in order to do that, we have a lot of convincing to do. And that's convincing among the 99%. Among the working class people. Because we have to... I think what we want to get them to understand is that if capitalism, with all its billionaires... And all this, I don't know the word to use, the opulent wealth. I mean, just dripping with money. Gold, I saw a gold cappuccino maker. Now, who in the hell need a gold cappuccino maker? I saw it at a hotel. You could use one. No, you can't. Well, we could all use, just give me a cappuccino maker. It ain't got to be made out of gold. Come on. This is just opulence. Just, in fact, well, okay, maybe I'm a hardcore, but I think it's a waste of wealth of human labor, because that's what labor is. Wealth is the embodiment of human labor, is what it is. Now, look, when you got all of this going on, you got to have it. Well, people still have to live, so a demand that the workers have brought up for years to try to bridge that gap between the minimum wage, between the youth unemployment and the prisons, and in, of course, the most skilled sections of the working class. As an electrician, I was making $50 an hour, let me be honest. And I'm not ashamed of it. They got their 50. They took my damn legs. They got their $50 an hour. Believe me, I worked for that money. But you know, you got to stop and think. What we need is, I think, and it was embodied in the slogan, we want a sliding scale of wages and hours. So on the one hand, we want the workday to shorten so that we can spread the available work around. Back in the days, we used to call it, for 30 for 40, make the bosses take the losses. That was, I carried such signs on the picket lines. I remember. This is where the consciousness of labor was at one point. We have to rebuild this, you know? So we need not just to have our platform as a pronouncement of where we want to go, but we want to show people how to get there as best we can. Do you have any closing remarks that you would like to make about your campaign?
Well, I want to say, you know, like yourself, I am a retired union member. but I still have union dues deducted from my pension check. And I wouldn't be having a pension if I hadn't been a member of a union. I've always been members of unions wherever I worked. And, you know, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt that said, if I were a worker, the first thing I would do is join a union. And so, yeah, I think it's important that people join unions and join, you know, the union struggle for better wages for their workers. But this has been always, the union movement has always not just been about this or that worker. It's been about the working class as a whole and a broad social movement. And it's unions in this country that have done so much. And I was up in Seattle when the 21st century first started in November 30th, 1999, when, you know, the workers, you know, there was a slogan there, Teamsters and Turtles, together at last, because that's when the working class, the union movement, the environmentalists, as well as the Sunday school teachers, the faith-based movement for social justice. We all got together there in Seattle, and that was really important. But as you know, they've clamped down since then. So we need, when they clamp down, we need to rise up. We need to move forward. And that's what this campaign is about. Not about me. It's about the Peace and Freedom Party, and it's about the working class and what we're going to do to change things in the 15th District and throughout the world. Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate your humbleness, but I got to say this to you, brother. You matter, because, in fact, you are running and not someone else. And the handful of people that still stand up to this system need to be supported so they're not out there on a limb by themselves. Okay? Please consider. Find out more about the Peace and Freedom Party and Gene Rule's campaign. Now, you were going to tell us a little bit about Cindy Sheehan. Why don't you share that with us? And just share that with us.
Well, Cindy Sheehan is one of my heroines. She has been on the forefront in the fight for peace and for social justice in this country. Many people may have forgotten, but Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey, was one of the first soldiers killed in the Iraq War. And Cindy couldn't figure out why this happened, so she went to see Bush to have him explain, well, why did we go to war in Iraq, and why did my son have to die for this war? And, of course, Bush wouldn't talk to her, so she set up a camp outside Bush's ranch in Texas and vowed to stay there until Bush would be willing to meet with her and explain why we were in the war in Iraq. And, of course, he never did. So she stayed there for I don't know how many months, Camp Casey in Texas, questioning the war in Iraq. Now, she went from questioning the war in Iraq and questioning Bush, she started to question this whole system of capitalist values, the whole war-addicted system of...
Doesn't she claim to be a socialist now?
She is indeed a socialist. As I said, she went from being a mom to being a peace mom, and then she became a revolutionary socialist. She joined the Peace and Freedom Party, and she's been endorsed by a number of my comrades, including the Party for Socialism and Liberation, the Peace and Freedom Party, in her campaign for governors, because she ran for Congress a couple of years ago in San Francisco against Democrat Nancy Pelosi. She did very well there, but she's moving on to the state level now. She's running what she calls an epic campaign, evoking memories of Upton Sinclair's epic campaign back in the 1920s, End Poverty in California.
And she's against police brutality. That's what I like.
She's a member of the Peace and Freedom Party, so that means she's against police brutality. She's against this whole prison industrial complex. She's for free education. She's for guaranteed single-payer health care. She's for urban renewal. She's for ending fracking in California. You might want to talk a little bit more about fracking one of these days. What their, you know, her slogan is, don't frack California. So don't elect more Democrats. Vote peace and freedom in the coming election, and also register peace and freedom, because that's a very significant way that you can let the bosses know why you are opposed to this system, why you're not voting for them. So register peace and freedom. Go to on the webpage. You can do it on the web. Go to registertovote.ca.gov, and there you can register online.
Well, thank you very much, brother, and I hope we have you back soon. That was very useful, very interesting listening to you. Right now, I'm going to play a song by Dave Rovics, and then we're going to come on with an interview with Bob Wells. Hang on.
When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers. All the highways were shut down. The cars were stuck in the garage, CEOs on bikes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. There was no one flipping burgers, all the grills were cold, onion rings were in their bags, fries were growing mold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. The fruit was falling off the trees, no one to load the truck. Corn was rotting on the stalks, no farmhands to shuck. The workfare workers were hanging at home, spending the day with their tykes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. Yuppie parents were housebound, their nannies left the job. Walmart workers said enough of our labor has been robbed. The footlocker was locked up, boss had to take a hike, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with T-Bone at the mic, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
Right. Now we got a special treat for you. I have here in the studio Brother Bob Wells. Now, I know Bob. We were in a common organization called the Labor Action Committee to free Mumia Abdul-Jamal. To tell you just a little bit about the Labor Action Committee, back in 1999, we worked with the Longshoremen, in collaboration with the Longshoremen, and the Longshoremen pulled off an entire West Coast one-day strike demanding that Mumia be free. That was on his birthday, August 24th of 1999. A deeply inspiring act. And that day, we had a demonstration of 25,000 people demanding freedom for Mumia Abdul-Jamal. So you can't say we didn't try. And by the way, it ain't over. As long as he's alive, we will continue to do everything in our power to get that brother out of jail. Bob was a part of this. Now, Bob, is now a retired teacher. Would you tell us a little bit about what the teachers did? Because the teachers organized through the union, through the OEA, a speak out to educate the children about Mumia Abdul-Jamal and the death penalty. This was officially voted through the union, and it became something that the Oakland Unified School District initially was going to cooperate with us. Then, if I recall, here's what happened. There was some crazed act on the freeway. Some guy shot a cop. And they tried to take that and say, oh, you guys are supporting a cop killer. We can't support a cop killer in the schools. We said, no. Mumia Abdul-Jamal is accused of killing. There's a mountain of evidence that proves that the man is innocent. So you're wrong. He's not a cop killer. You're wrong. We're not trying to support a cop killer. And you're wrong. People do need to know about his case, and people do need to know about the death penalty. Rather than to try to slide by, we took it back to the union. And the delegates of the union voted again to have this speak out for the students. But fill us in on the details of that before we get into the other matter.
In 1999, a high school teacher in the Oakland School District named Sarah Fuchs had put together on her own a curriculum about the Mumia case, how he was framed by the Philadelphia police for killing a cop in 1982. And a member of the Oakland Education Association executive board, Bob Mandel, and Sarah Fuchs took that curriculum and turned it into a district-wide teach-in that actually took place from kindergarten through high school, in not every class, but at every level. And the mayor, Jerry Brown, was against it. The president of the school board was against it. The newspapers were against it. The TVs were against it. Everybody was against it except the teachers and the students. And to cut to the chase, we went ahead, even though the day before the teach-in was supposed to take place, a police officer was shot and killed in Oakland. And they said, oh, well, as Gerald said, now you can't do it. And we said, no, there's no connection. There's no connection. Mumia had nothing to do with killing a police officer. So we went ahead with it, and it turned out that it was one of the most productive teaching experiences of that school year. There were kids coming to class who the teachers hadn't seen for weeks. And these were kids who had kind of come up through the school system without really learning how to read and write. And they were sitting in the classrooms taking notes on the Constitution, on the laws, and coming to terms and grasping this case. The lawyer from Mumia came out from the East Coast and met with students at Oakland High School. It was a great success. And the fact that everybody who didn't like it, they were wrong. And we were right, and we did it.
I just want to add just a little to that, and that is I was given the task of kind of archiving it. So they gave me all of the letters and the compositions that the students wrote And I'll be honest with you now. Let's always be honest. Don't make it an exception. I kind of was skeptical how much the kids would actually get into it, you know. I said, well, we'll just see if we can shove it down their little throats and they'll digest some of it. I was absolutely wrong. My expectations were far too low. I read probably about 100 of these little essays. And I tell you, I'm not a real, you know, softy. I'm not a, try not to be too emotional. But I was almost brought to tears when I read some of these kids' essays on Mumia Abu-Jamal. What they learned, what they felt about it, why they felt he should be free. These are children. I said, wow. And I'm not talking about just high school kids. Some of these kids were 10, 9 years old. And no, the English was not perfect, but it was perfect to me. And you could see the motivation, you know, that they really wanted to get into it. So that, all right, that's how me and Bob met. Now, I think, Bob, you also have other experience. You were a member of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, were you not? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, in Chicago, I was a member of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, which I think the proposition of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was that it's a mistake to leave it to the government and the state to combat the Klan, the Nazis, and the street-level racists, because the government is more racist than they are. And so the people have to do it. And the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee undertook to confront the racist skinheads, the KKK, and the there's actually a group in Chicago that called themselves Romantic Violence. And so we confronted them directly on the streets. I think what Gerald is driving at one point, in order to interfere with our work, the FBI came up with a couple of letters that somebody had cut by scissors out of a newspaper and turned it into a threat against the government and the government officials in our name. And, of course, we had nothing to do with that. And they called me in Chicago and a fellow in San Francisco, Camomile, to come to a grand jury. And at that point, we were in solidarity with third world groups that, as a matter of principle, refused to appear before grand juries because this was a way to deconstruct and disorganize the people's movements. And so we refused. We thought we were going to be looking at a lot of time at the Metropolitan Correctional Center for contempt. But although they didn't tell us this, it was only a 3-month grand jury instead of an 18-month. And when we held out for 3 months, they said, okay, don't do it again. And they let us go.
You know, I get tired of these humble-ass folks. Between Gene and Bob, you know, you think they talk so, you know, it's just they matter-of-factly. This was a big deal to me. I'm extremely impressed at the courage these guys had to stand up to the state and say, no, no, we will not collaborate with our own oppression. They refused to participate in their non-collaboration philosophy. It was not just, it was a principle. And they refused to collaborate. They refused to go along with it. And they won. Let's be clear about this. They won. And when they won, we won. So I compliment you on that, brother. That is it's not just a minor little deal. I wish that more people would follow your example. You know what I mean? Because it's not easy to stand up to the government that way. And it's even harder to win. But could you please tell us now a little bit about... See, Bob has done something that you don't see that often, okay? A few years ago, I noticed there was a controversy in Chicago. A group of parents wanted the book Huckleberry Finn taken off of the mandatory reading list because the word nigger was in the book. I'm a little sympathetic to the parents because I understand we don't want to use that word. We don't want our kids using that word. But we also have to learn to respect history. And also, I want to tell you, the parents that pushed this probably had never read the book. Okay? Because Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain is actually an anti-racist track. It's a story of a young boy, Huck, on a barge. He's done run away from home and having his little adventure. And he hooks up with a guy, a black man, named Jim. Is that right? And Jim is an escaped slave. Now, I remember I read this book when I was a child. But I'll never forget this. At one point, somebody asked Huck, they say, all right now, you know, if you protecting that Negro, you're going to go straight to hell. And Huck said to himself, well, I guess I'm going to hell then. Human loyalty is a powerful force. And for his own reasons, Huck refused to collaborate with the racists in capturing Jim. In fact, they both went off, and if I remember the book correctly, they just went off on the barge and they went on. I never did know what happened to them. You know, I kind of forgot the end of the book. But guess what? Bob has embarked on a project that's quite noteworthy. He decided to continue the story of Huckleberry Finn. Now, I'm not going to steal your thunder. I'm going to stop there. And here is, if you need it, the notes. Okay, so he's going to tell us what this book that he wrote, which is called Passing Through the Territory, is about.
In The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain has the two main characters, Jim, who has walked off the farm where he's been held as a slave because the woman who owns the farm has sold his wife and children into the southern slave trade, and he is bound and determined to get himself free, to get some money together, and to bring his family back together again. And this was a theme that was throughout slavery days in the South. The people were struggling to keep their families together, and of course, the slave system was breaking families up. This is the truth, I swear to God, and I have the reference. Slaveholders were selling children by the pound, selling babies by the pound. Too young to work, they were running for $7 to $10 a pound in the 1850s. So Jim was determined to... Jim was the... And, well...
It's the truth. We need to know.
There's more than that. A lot of these babies were their own kids, fathered from slave women, selling babies. But anyway, Jim decided he was going to bring his family back together again, and so he walked off the farm. And at the same time, here's Huckleberry Finn, a 13 or 14-year-old kid who was born and growing up in the slaveholding South, who just... took as gospel the white supremacist racism of the South, and the two of them run into each other on the Mississippi River, and they run off together. And of course, the slave patrols are hot on Jim's heels, and Huckleberry covers for him and considers himself to be damned because he's breaking more than the law. He's breaking the way the world is supposed to be, but he won't betray his friend. But then at the end of the book, for whatever reason, and there's a whole lot of academic discussion of what happened, Mark Twain lets the whole thing evaporate. He never follows up about Jim finding his family. He never brings it together about Huckleberry and his contradictions. He just lets the whole thing evaporate. And many people, including me, when I read it, were unhappy with that. But, you know, the book is written. What can you do?
It's a great book.
Yeah, and And what Mark Twain does during the book is he's challenging at the time the white supremacist assumptions of the South. And what Huckleberry goes through in the book is the same thing that Mark Twain, or Samuel Clemens, which is his real name, actually went through in the same place at the same age in the state of Missouri. But then I had been wanting to write something about John Brown, who I felt was not... America is not paying attention to John Brown, because if it does, it will be shaken. John Brown is brushed off as being a Father Christmas type with a long white beard, and usually as being some kind of insane person, which is exactly the word they use. It's the same word they use for anybody who opposed slavery and anybody who opposed Jim Crow. Crazy. You know, that's the word. Nat Turner, Malcolm X, Huey P. Newton, Sojourner Truth, they're all called, but they say, crazy niggers. And John Brown threw himself totally in with them. He was crazy too. It's a way of dismissing what he had to say. What he had to say was that the contradiction between black and white, if it wasn't resolved, was going to bring this republic down. And he's still correct about that. So I wanted to write something about John Brown, and then it registered on me that it's the same time that Huck and Jim were traveling in Missouri, John Brown was carrying out his famous 1858 slave freeing raid in Missouri, in which he raided the farms, took people off the farms who were being held as slaves, and with 11 slaves, now contraband fugitives, John Brown and his company, which included his sons, traveled across the winter prairie to Chicago and then to Detroit, with these 11 people crossed into freedom in Canada. And then John Brown and his men turned and went back down to Harper's Ferry. So what I did was I picked up where Mark Twain had left off with Huckleberry Finn, and Jim picked them up, put them in connection with John Brown and his men, and they all go off together to the Kansas border war.
All right, now, here's where the missing pages come in, because these are the missing pages of American history. Unfortunately, John Brown has been somewhat erased. You pick up the average book about American history, and you will not see a mention of John Brown, his raid on Harper Ferry, or anything else. But just what this period that he's talking about now is there was conflict in America over slavery. The slave owners, opportunistic in their approach, unscientific and arrogant, would constantly grow cotton because cotton was the cash crop in America. Up until 1925, cotton was the main source of international trade for the United States. 1925. Most people don't know that. Cotton was king. But if you keep growing cotton, guess what happens? You deplete the soil. What is necessary is crop rotation. You grow cotton, then you grow peas, then you grow something else, and you put nutrients back into the soil. Well, ain't no arrogant, ignorant slave owner worrying about the soil. He just want the money. And no appreciation of science, obviously, or his environment. So as they depleted the soil, they wanted to go westward and have more slavery. They needed to have more land to exploit. This led to pretty serious debates in the Congress of the United States and what was called the Missouri Compromise. In other words, how do we decide if we bring in another state inside the Union, is it going to be slave or free? So would you take a minute, Bob, just a minute, and explain the Missouri Compromise and then the bleeding of Kansas?
The movement in Congress was not to end slavery, but to to prevent the spread of slavery from the South. The Southern slaveholders wanted to expand into Cuba. They wanted to expand into Mexico, and they did expand into Mexico, and the result of that is the state of Texas. Do what you want with that. They almost took over Honduras. They had Confederate guerrillas operating in Honduras. And they wanted to spread all the way across to the West Coast. And so the compromise in 1820 was that Missouri would be allowed to enter the Union as a slave state. And I think it was Maine was allowed to come in at the same time as a free state. But then from the southern border of Missouri, a line would be drawn across the continent, and no more slavery and no more new slave states would be permitted north of that line. And of course, the slave holders immediately began operating to try to break the compromise. And some, I think 25 years later, they came up with what they called the settlers in these new territories would be able to decide for themselves.
Vote.
Yeah, to vote for themselves if they wanted to come into the Union as a slave state or not. North of the line, too, so the compromise was broken. So there were two territories just west of where the United States ended at that time. Nebraska was west of, Kansas was exactly west of the state of Missouri, and just north of Kansas was the territory of Nebraska. So they were going to come in. Nebraska was going to come in as a free state with no slavery permitted. And all through the South and in Missouri, the assumption was that Kansas would come in as another slave state, which would maintain the hammerlock which the slave owners had on all levels of the national government. And when it came time to vote on the territorial constitution in the territory of Kansas, it wasn't a state yet, hundreds, thousands of what they called border ruffians and Missouri ruffians crossed from Missouri into Kansas. And they were what they even called themselves one-day voters. There were districts where 100 voters were registered. The pro-slavery constitution carried by 1,000 votes. And then they would ride back to Kansas the next day. I mean, ride back to Missouri. So the abolitionists in New England started sending wagon trains of settlers from New England into Kansas to build up a free state constituency. And so, as typical, the slave holders went directly to violence. Burning, shooting, intimidation, and at first, the New Englanders weren't ready for that. Then they started fighting back. And they started fighting back when John Brown and a small group of his companions and sons took up the gun, took up the sword against slavery, and made the thing a fight and not just a terrorization. So there was actually the Civil War, the violence of the Civil War actually began in Kansas in the 1850s. Probably 4 and 5 years before the Civil War itself started. It was a vicious fight. Vicious fight. No mercy shown from the slavers, and finally no mercy shown by anybody. And that border fighting continued all through the Civil War. And so John Brown, who wanted to take his fighters from Kansas into the Deep South, finally said, well, I don't have to wait any longer. Here's Missouri right next door. That's a slave state. So they went over there and freed these slaves. And the slaveholding South commenced to have a meltdown about it.
Well, so give us a little glimpse then of the direction that you went with your book. And then we have a nice surprise for our listening audience.
Well, See, the thing is, the Huckleberry Finn that I kind of inherited from Mark Twain was still the same kid. And he was still whipsawed between the question of whether he should stick up for his friend, but he was still just terribly guilty about turning his back on the white supremacist truisms that he thought he'd learned as growing up in the South. And so what he does when he's finally out on his own, Jim is somewhere else, and Huck is at this point traveling on his own, he hooks up with a militia that's coming in from Georgia, crossing Missouri to get into the Kansas fighting in support of slavery. Because it was drawing racists from all over the place to go there and fight to make that a slave state. So to make up for his sins of defending his friend, who is black, he hooks up with this militia. They just use him as a servant, but he thinks he's going to get right with heaven that way. And as they're crossing Missouri, and this is right out of the history books, the militia gets ambushed by John Brown. who shoots them to pieces, turns them around and sends them back where they came from. But John Brown is looking around at the prisoners and he says, "Who's this kid?" Well, he's actually a lot more dignified than that. He says, "Who is this?" And he says to the Southern Colonel, he says, "Is this your son?" And the Southern Colonel is horrified that he would be connected with this trash, you know, white runaway orphan. He says, "No, he's nothing to me. I don't even know who he is." So John Brown keeps him. And Huckleberry, in with John Brown and his company and his men, the thing about Huckleberry Finn is he's an orphan. And he's looking for some place to belong. And he didn't really belong where he was, and he didn't really belong after he ran away, and he didn't really belong with this racist militia that was coming in. And finally, he has a feeling of belonging with John Brown, partly because they're decent and anybody else he'd run into up to that point wasn't, but also because John Brown's sons were his age. And he wanted to be part of that. And so he joined up with them and traveled. And as they're going across Missouri, freeing slaves, they bring in Jim. And when they see that he and Jim know each other, they say, "Oh man, this kid is not a he's not a slaver. He's one of us." But then it turns out that to stay with them, he's going to have to go all the way to Harper's Ferry. Although he doesn't know it's Harper's Ferry, he knows what's coming. And he's seen enough people at that point get blown to pieces by firearms, Bowie knives, and explosives that he just doesn't want. It's not that he's personally afraid, he just doesn't want to be around that. So they tell him, "Okay, it's an honorable position that you had, that you don't want to take part in this violence, but that's what we're heading for, so you've got to find your own way again." So, now, okay, well, then I'll... he's crossing the prairie. By this time, he's on horseback. It's the winter on the prairie, which is freezing cold. And he finally decides that he's not going to be able to fit in Canada with the freed slaves there, with Jim and his new family. And he's not going to be able to stay with John Brown and his sons. So at the very end of the book, in the last chapter, he pulls aside and turns back to the Mississippi River.
Now, look, it's hard. Just that little taste, I hope, will serve your appetite a bit for creativity and knowledge. But here is, I think, an interesting twist to all of this. Mumia Abdul-Jamal, who is currently incarcerated, wrote the following letter to Bob. Bob sent Mumia Abdul-Jamal a copy of the book, Inside Prison. Mumia read it and sent Bob the following letter, and I'm quoting it right now. "I have just 2 minutes ago, finished your manuscript, Passing Through the Territory. I must say it takes balls the size of basketballs to write what is, in effect, an addendum to Mark Twain's classic Huck Finn. Well done. Historic vision, to be sure. But to a student of history, the voice, the very quotes of the old captain come shining through, giving him, well, I can't see, muscle and meat, muscle and bone. I didn't think anyone but Terry Bisson could do such a thing and do it justice. I now see that I was wrong. I love the rhythms of the language, the dialects, both black and white, and the naturalness of it all. It is a bold stab at an American classic that needs new blood to give it life. In a time when some milquetoast publishers seek to bleed it out of its life and power by abolishing the so-called N-word. The surest sign that an American literature is dead. On that note, I respectfully suggest you restore the original text of page 156-59. I think Bob had taken the word nigger out because it was such a controversy here in America. So Mumia said, no, you should restore it, for it seems like you prematurely took nigger out of Huck's vocabulary when it certainly was still in his head. This, like American slavery itself, is the marrow of the very meaning of America. It is its story, one we have all but forgotten in this false hour of so-called post-racialism. I expect it's been published now, and I can only hope that young people read it, and I learn from it, and they learn from it, much in the ways that Twain taught generations before us. Well done, Robert. Thanks for quite a good read. Now, actually, the book is yet to be published. It's not as easy today to get books published as it was, but this book, I am hoping, will. I've read it. And while I thought the language was a little thick, it certainly was authentic. You see, we're not used to that. We're not accustomed to that. You know, real Americana, understanding how people communicated in the past. So I'm now going to play a CD of Mumia actually reading the last chapter of the book. Hold on 1 second.
Getting back to the Mississippi River, whether or not he found the skipper and the mate. busy steamboat traffic always had a berth for another deckhand. But like all the rivermen, including Sam Clements himself, Huck would have been there at the end of an era, barely more than 2 years after Huck parted company with Jim and Aaron Stevens. And Captain Brown, the coming of the Civil War, put an end to life as it had been on the Mississippi. In 1859, before he was hanged, Huckleberry's captain made a prophecy. "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had, as I now think vainly, flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done." In the 4 years and 1 month from Fort Sumter to Appomattox, the Civil War killed 620,000 men in battlefield deaths alone. And John Brown's prophecy is still not fulfilled. In 1861, Huckleberry Finn would have been 17 or 18 years old. Would he have soldiered? In which army? Some questions remain. The end. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Wow. Well, Bahab, I just have to thank you for all of this, and I want you to know that it's my deep, deep hope that I'm going to have you back in the studio, and that, you know, we can hear, so hopefully a publisher will take up this continuity of Americana, this particular novel, which I find personally very, very interesting. But that's going to be all now from Radical Perspectives. We air our program every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 12 noon, and we hope that you will join us next week here at Berkeley Liberation Radio. Thank you very much. I'm going to close out with a little Dave Rovick.
When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers, all the highways were shut down. The cars were stuck in the garage, CEOs on bikes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. There was no one flipping burgers, all the grills were cold. Onion rings were in their bags, fries were growing mold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. The fruit was falling off the trees, no one to load the truck. Corn was rotting on the stalks, no farmhands to shuck. The workfare workers were hanging at home, spending the day with their tykes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. We'll be right back. Yuppie parents were housebound, their nannies left the job. Walmart workers said enough of our labor has been robbed. The footlocker was locked up, boss had to take a hike. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with T-Bone at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers